Hi, I'm Dave Summers, and welcome to AMA's Edgewise, where you will hear fresh insights from recognized thought leaders across a wide range of subject matter. AMA's Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. The AMA is a global leader in professional development and education, improving the immediate performance and long-term growth of individuals and organizations. Check us out on our website, www.amanet.org. In the wake of 9/11, Southwest Airlines was faced with a disastrous situation that threatened to ruin not only their business, but the entire airline industry. In response, Southwest Airlines made three pivotal decisions: no layoffs, no pay cuts, and no hassle refunds for any customer wanting them. The result? Southwest remained profitable. It was the only major airline to protect the jobs of all of its employees, and Southwest's market cap soon exceeded all its major competitors combined. How is this possible? James F. Parker served as the CEO of Southwest Airlines during that tumultuous period. In his new book, Do the Right Thing, Jim shows why doing the right thing by your employees and your customers isn't just naive feel-goodism, it's the most powerful rule for business success. His decisions grew naturally from Southwest's culture of mutual respect and trust. Parker offers deeply personal insights into that culture, demonstrating that it's not really that hard to do the right thing. Welcome to Edgewise, Jim.
It's great to be with you today, Dave. Thank you.
What prompted you to name your book, Do the Right Thing?
Dave, I think it really comes back to what I call the round world theory, which is kind of a Texas way of saying what goes around comes around. In other words, what we do today, we may think that we're done with it and it's gone, but the truth is it's going to come back around, maybe not tomorrow, but at some point we're going to see the consequences of what we do today. And I think a great example of this was something I experienced at Southwest Airlines during 9/11. I had become the CEO in June of 2001. 3 months later, we have the greatest attack on America we had ever had. And it was a very traumatic experience in the airline business, especially, of course, because planes were put on the ground. Several airlines faced questions as to whether they could survive. Every other major airline in the United States laid off at least 20% of their employees, cut the pay of their employees, and so forth. We didn't do that at Southwest. We continued to employ all of our people, fly all of our airplanes, but we were pretty worried about whether we would be able to survive. And one of the first decisions we made was to give our customers unquestioned refunds, which could have been hundreds of millions of dollars. It could have drained our coffers. That, incidentally, is something other airlines really didn't do, was to give unquestioned refunds. But we decided to do it at some financial risk to ourselves. And somewhat surprisingly, the flood of refund requests never came. On the contrary, we had people actually calling us, sending us letters saying, you keep the money, you need it more than we do. Customers actually sent us money, wanting to make contributions to make sure our company survived. And I think that was really a consequence of everything that had happened in our 30-year history up to that time with our customers bonding with our company because they loved our employees, they loved our culture, our service, and our employees had just dedicated their lives to building a great airline and bonding with our customers. So I think that's just one example of how if you do the right thing every day, you never know when it's going to come back and visit you, but ultimately it does. And ultimately, the way we treat other people has a lot to do with the way that they treat us back.
So it's really about taking a long-term view of business.
I think it's a good way to put it.
But at that time, I'm sure you weren't just totally confident it was all going to work out. The whole industry was on the brink of collapse. Just take us through the story of that whole experience.
It was a very trying time, and every airline employee was very concerned about the future of our industry. We didn't know initially when we would be allowed to get back in the air. Of course, all of our airplanes were initially grounded by the FAA for several days. We really didn't know whether there was going to be an airline industry after 9/11. And of course, our employees didn't know whether they were going to have jobs. All of the other major airlines did make the decision that they were going to have to furlough employees. We didn't do that. We kept our company together. We kept our people together. It was really a long-term investment in the culture of our company, deciding that we weren't going to take the quick and easy path of trying to reduce some costs by laying off people. Southwest Airlines had never had an involuntary furlough in the history of our company. And this was a huge test of our will in that regard. We also had a huge profit sharing payment that was due in 3 days. We were scheduled to pay $187 million of cash into our employees' profit sharing accounts on September 14th. We had made a request to the banks to draw on our credit lines to be sure that we would have enough cash, but it wasn't clear whether the banking system was going to be operative or whether the banks would be able to meet all of the calls, because every airline, of course, immediately made a request to draw down their cash because we knew we were going to be in a cash game here for a while. And several airlines privately predicted that they wouldn't be able to survive. Ultimately, most of them did file for bankruptcy, of course, within a reasonably short period of time after 9/11. But that's one thing that I am proud that our company did. And even today, 3 years after I've retired from the company, almost every time I get on an airplane and fly, some employee or employees will come up to me and let me know that they remember what we did as a company. And they'll tell me stories about how they were about to get married or about to buy a house or something of that nature. They didn't know whether they were going to have a career or be able to do that. And they remember what the company did for them. And I think that kind of thing created a long-term effect on their perception of their relationship with the company. It's something they'll carry with them throughout their career. It is, I think, just another example of how if you do the right thing, it's going to come back and visit you, because they will be able to carry that experience on, not just through their career, but through the stories that they're telling to other employees who might be hired decades from now.
This sounds exactly like the kind of company culture that was envisioned and established from the very beginning by Southwest's first CEO, Herb Kelleher. And in fact, from the founding of Southwest, you worked with Herb, did you not?
Yes.
He's really one of the legendary CEOs. His name and his reputation just keep coming up over and over again. What did you learn about leadership from him?
Herb is a legendary figure in the history of not just the airline industry, but in the history of business, in the history of America. I've known a lot of smart people in my life. I've known a lot of charismatic people. And I've known a lot of people who had great business instincts, but I've never known one person who combined them all the way that Herb does. I mean, he is a business genius who is charismatic, who is brilliant, who can talk about any subject. He would come in one day talking to us about Einstein's theory of general relativity and another day talking about dog food. He is loved by the employees, has been, and he's a great motivator and inspiration as a leader. You asked, what did I learn about leadership? I guess I'd say everything, but if I had to distill it down to one thing that I learned from Herb over and above everything else, it would be that leadership is not really about you, but rather it's about inspiring other people to be the very best that they can be.
And as a CEO, was it difficult following in Herb's footsteps?
I was often asked what it was like to follow a great leader like Herb, and all I could say was, I'm not Herb. I can't be Herb. I wish I could, but there are no more like Herb. It's impossible to try to be Herb. All I can do is be myself. And I was finally asked by one reporter who said, how would you compare your charisma to that of Herb Kelleher? And I was taken aback for a moment, and I finally said, comparing my charisma to Herb Kelleher would be like comparing the light and energy put out by a 60-watt bulb to that put out by the sun. I told Herb that, and he said, what makes you think you're 60 watts?
In your book, you have a lot of great stories about the early days of Southwest, when it was battling it out against steep odds and cutthroat competitors. Tell us about the Texas Whiskey War.
The Great Texas Whiskey War is a great story. Southwest wanted to be a low-fare, high-quality service that took people where they wanted to go at a price they could afford to pay. And Texas offered a great opportunity in that it's geographically a large state with some large population centers. But the competitors, the entrenched incumbents at that time, somehow thought the idea of competition was kind of un-American. There was such oppressive anti-competitive campaign by the incumbent airlines that ultimately Braniff and Texas International became the first U.S. airlines ever to actually be indicted and convicted for criminal violations of the federal antitrust laws. But at one point, Southwest funds were almost dried up, and Braniff knew very well that Southwest was basically breaking even, maybe making a small profit on the Dallas-Houston route, but was losing money on the Dallas-San Antonio route. So Southwest started charging $26 fares on their Texas routes, which was a great reduction from what the fares had been. In an effort to stimulate the Dallas-San Antonio route, which was losing money, Southwest announced a promotional fare of $13 to just try to get people on the airplane. Braniff saw their opportunity to pounce and knew that Southwest was almost out of money. So Braniff ran full-page ads in the Dallas and Houston newspapers announcing that they were going to have an introductory fare sale of $13 to give Braniff a chance to introduce itself to the people of Texas, which was kind of surprising since they had been flying for 30 years in Texas. But they knew very well that nobody, not even Southwest, could make money at $13 a passenger. So Southwest faced a tough choice, a seemingly insoluble conundrum, really, of how to respond to this $13 fare that Braniff had introduced on the one lifeline route that Southwest had left. The choices seemingly were cut your fares to $13 and lose money on every passenger, in which case you would soon run out of money, or keep your fares at $26 and lose enough passengers that you would soon run out of money. Southwest came up with a fairly creative response to the insoluble conundrum and announced in the next Monday newspapers in full-page ads, telling people that if they thought that the $26 fare, the new low price that Southwest had brought to Texas, was a fair price, that they needed to understand that if Southwest went away, there wouldn't be $26 fares anymore. But the reality was, we knew our competitor had $13 fares. So if people felt that that was a reasonable price to pay for their ticket, come on, get on the airplane, pay us $13, and we'll gladly fly you between Dallas and Houston. On the other hand, if you think $26 is a fair price to pay, come on, get on the airplane, pay us $26, and to show our appreciation, when you get off the plane, we will hand you a free bottle of whiskey. And for a period of time, Southwest Airlines became the leading liquor distributor in the state of Texas. The people got it. It was a great marketing idea, and it really backfired on Braniff, because suddenly Texans just took Southwest to their breast and claimed it as their own. And really, from that point forward, that was in 1973, Southwest turned the corner, made a profit of about $170,000, and has been profitable every year since.
And it was all thanks to whiskey.
All thanks to whiskey.
Southwest has done a remarkable job at keeping the energy and entrepreneurial spirit of its early days, even as it's become the most successful airline in America. How has it done that?
It takes a lot of effort to keep the spirit of a company alive as you grow. It's harder as you become more spread out and as you have 30,000 employees and locations all over the country. The key really is to have good leaders at every level of the organization, people who understand the mission of your company, who understand how you want to deal with employees, how you want to deal with customers, people who are able to keep that culture alive at every city, at every maintenance base, at every reservation center, and so forth, because it can't all come from the headquarters. You can have a CEO who believes in all these lofty ideals, and you can have a great mission statement, but the truth of the matter is, most employees in any large company are never going to meet the CEO of their company. They'll probably never read the mission statement, and it would be meaningless to them anyway if they didn't see it demonstrated in their workplace. You know that. I know that. Everybody knows that. You can work for a great company that has a great CEO, but if your immediate boss is a lousy boss, or if you don't enjoy working with the people who are around you, if you have lousy fellow employees, you're not going to enjoy your job. For example, we were hiring pilot applicants, and there was a highly decorated military pilot who was expected to have a brilliant career in the military and decided to go into the private sector. We knew that he was highly sought after, had been offered jobs at other airlines, and he decided to come to Southwest. He came in, he did his interview. When he got home, he was rather surprised to receive a letter saying he had not been selected. When he called in asking why he hadn't been selected, he was a high-quality pilot, highly decorated and respected military man. The answer was because he had been rude to the receptionist. I think that demonstrates what we were looking for at Southwest. We were looking for people who were not me-oriented, but people who were other-oriented, people who enjoyed life, who enjoyed being around other people, to whom customer service was not a dirty word, but it was an honored concept.
Now, looking ahead at 2008, there's anxiety about whether we're going to slip into another recession. So let's say you were a CEO of a company going into 2008. How does a CEO or a company do the right thing given the economic climate that we're facing?
I think anytime you're in a position of leading a company, you have a lot of different demands and a lot of constituencies that you're trying to respond to. Obviously, you have shareholders. You have to be focused on building shareholder value, to use a cliche. But you also have obligations to employees and to customers. And the overarching obligation you have, I think, is to build a company that will have a sustainable competitive advantage. So you're trying to balance all of these things together. And you can't just worship at the altar of one of these deities who are making demands on you. You always want to be conscious of what they call shareholder value, but I personally believe that a lot of shareholder value has been destroyed over the years by people making short-term decisions to cut costs, for example, by cutting employees who might be performing vital functions within the company. You can destroy your product or your service, or you can do great damage to it by making short-term decisions to try to enhance shareholder value or cut cost or increase revenues by overpromising and under-delivering, for example. We always tried to do the opposite at Southwest, under-promise and over-deliver. We tried to make long-term decisions that would sustain the culture of our company while sustaining the value of our shareholders. You just have to balance all those things. Now, having said that, companies can come to the point where, as much as I care about protecting the jobs of employees and as hard as I worked to do that while I was a CEO at Southwest, you have to make a hard decision in the interest of the organization as a whole and the long-term survivability of the company that you just have to do some downsizing or you have to stop doing some things that are losing money. That seems to be a hard concept for some people to come to grips with, that maybe you need to stop doing things that lose money. But that's a part of the business process. So it's always a balancing, I think, of those interests. But I think the overriding thing is to remember that you do have obligations to employees and customers as well as shareholders, and try to maintain an environment where you're creating a long-term, sustainable competitive advantage for your company.
I'm curious, does Southwest have ethics guidelines or behavioral guidelines? Is it something as codified as that, or is it something that was just in the air and everybody was breathing it in? You talked about doing the right thing. Was this just something everybody was naturally gifted at?
In this highly regulated era of Sarbanes-Oxley and accounting regulations and all the government regulations and things that we have, everybody's supposed to have codes of ethics and standards of conduct and all these things. And we did all that. We adopted the written code of ethics, where we never really had had such a detailed standard of ethics before. And of course, we did everything that was expected of us as Sarbanes-Oxley. My personal opinion is that none of that was really in advance from the days when we just used to tell people to do the right thing and use the sense God gave a goose. If you give people a chance to do the right thing, they usually will.
It takes a lot of confidence to say that.
It takes a lot of confidence in your people, and I think you do have to create a culture in which people want to do the right thing. You can write all the rules you want, but ultimately, anybody with a business degree and a sense of creativity can find a way to get around a rule. What it's harder to get around is a concept of doing the right thing. If you can get people to understand that that is their duty, that's what's expected of them. And you do have to create a culture in which people want to do the right thing. And that really is the role of leadership, I think. Leadership is ultimately ethical. Defining the ethics and culture of an organization is what a leader does. And if employees see their leaders taking ethical shortcuts, they're going to think that that is the standard of conduct that's expected of them. But if they see leaders who don't take ethical shortcuts, who are honest and accept the consequences of mistakes when they make mistakes, pass along the credit to the people who deserve credit when something good happens, they're going to understand that that's the culture in which they live, and that's the conduct that's expected of them as well.
Well, thanks a lot, Jim. I guess it's time to wrap things up.
Whatever you want to do, or we can talk about college football.
Maybe next time, Jim. The name of the book is Do the Right Thing, and the author is James Parker. Remember, we'd really like your feedback, so please drop us an email note at podcast@amanet.org or call us at 800-697-3406. That's 800-697-3406. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.